The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.
Welcome back to another Kiefer and Curry. He is Kip Kiefer. I am Tony Curry. We do the show every single week. It's heard at least five times a week here on the TKR app. Download that TKR app like 100,000 folks have already done. Of course, you can hear us wherever you're available on your podcast network. Just search Tony Curry Radio or Kiefer and Curry. And Kip, how you doing? You ready to do another show here? I'm going to do the topic this week. You ready, brother?
Tony, I'm always ready, and I always enjoy your topic ideas, so fire away.
So, 2009, Farrah Fawcett passed away on June 25th, which was this past Sunday. We're recording this show here on Tuesday the 27th. And she had a direct effect not only on me, but she had a huge effect on every 12-year-old at that point in their lives. And I'll never forget because I wasn't allowed to have posters in my bedroom. And, of course, the Farrah Fawcett poster, we all know the red poster, the red bikini at the top of the one piece with her teeth just shining through. And everybody had that poster. And I actually had that poster, but I could not put it up my wall because my dad was like, we don't put that kind of stuff up on our walls. And I think I was about 12 or 13 years of age when that happened. So I found a picture of Farrah Fawcett of the same poster. It was black and white inside the Cincinnati Enquirer inside the entertainment section. And it was probably about 3 inches by an inch. I mean, that's how small it was. And again, it was in black and white. It was newsprint from like the mid-70s. And so I cut it out and I taped it above my floor. I was in a bunk bed and I was on the bottom bunk and my brother was on the top. And I taped it above my bed so I could look at it when I went to sleep at night. And one night I couldn't believe my dad, because my dad never came in to give me a hug goodnight. He never tucked me in. He was always in bed already. He came in to say goodnight and he saw that in my bed. And he was like, what the hell is that? And I said, that's Farrah Fawcett. And he's like, why do you have a picture of Farrah Fawcett in your bed? And I was like, and so he ripped it down. So when she passed away, obviously a lot of people love Farrah Fawcett. I think she may have won an Emmy for something from Charlie's Angels. She obviously did The Burning Bed. She did some movies. She was on Fantasy Island, and a lot of people just really love Farrah Fawcett. She was America's sweetheart. And then, of course, later on, she also did a spread in Playboy, which was unbelievable. But she passed away this past Sunday on June 25th. And the only reason we don't remember that is because on that same day in 2009,
unbelievable,
Michael Jackson also passed away. And so imagine you're going into, say, Lester Holt, you're going into NBC Nightly News and you're getting ready to break the story about Farrah Fawcett. And then Michael Jackson passes away like less than 2 hours later. And you're like, okay, where are we going with this? She didn't get anything on that particular news cycle day because Michael Jackson, obviously, the king of pop, had won that thing. So I was trying to think, and obviously both those deaths had a huge impact on my life. We always say, where were you when this happened? I remember I saw James Taylor just about a week ago past Sunday at Oak Mountain Amphitheater. The last time I saw him play at Oak Mountain was I was in the car and I was getting on the interstate at about 11 o'clock at night, and it came across the radio that Lady Di had passed away. And by the way, her birthday is coming up this Saturday. She would have been 63 years of age. She passed away years ago, 26 years ago. It's hard to believe it's been 26 years. And so that had an impact on my life. And so I wanted to get into celebrity infamous deaths that have affected us most. And we always kind of pick four, and I wanted you to kind of go through that. So tell me what your thoughts are on this topic and then get into your first one.
Well, I'm going to go way, way back, and this was probably more than a celebrity. When you brought that up, I immediately thought of my four, and this one is beyond a celebrity because he was president of the United States. Tony, I was in kindergarten the day that John F. Kennedy, November 22nd, 1963, was assassinated in Dallas, Texas. I was 4 years old, which I still have some resentment for because my parents started me way too early in school. If I could have been redshirted that year and started when everybody else did the next year, but I guess I was just such a pain in the rear end that they wanted to get me out of the house. But, you know, I was always the youngest kid in my high school and my senior class, and athletically and socially, you know, who knows? I might be running the whole show right now had they not made that mistake. But I remember coming home and that November afternoon and walking down the hill from getting out of the bus. Again, you know, at the ripe old age of four, I can't these days, you can't leave the house without armed guards if you're under seven. But walking down the street sidewalk, and my mother is sitting on the front porch of our house, just uncontrollably sobbing. We live in Washington, D.C., right outside of downtown D.C. in Rockville, Maryland, which is a very close suburb. And she's bawling, just crying uncontrollably. And of course, the first thing a four-year-old's going to do, and this is burnt in my memory like it was yesterday, and I don't think people have a lot of memories of their four-year-old year, but was so traumatic that I ran up and, you know, mommy, what's the matter? What's happening? And she looked at me, and Tony, I'll never, ever forget this, eye-to-eye contact, just like I was a grown-up person that needed that respect. She said, they've killed the president. Oh. And I remember just even being a little kid and living in Washington, there was so much, you know, so much about living there was being tied into what was happening in D.C. And, you know, in the subsequent years, we would go on field trips to the Lincoln Memorial, the Washington Memorial, the Ford's Theater, the Smithsonian Institution. I mean, what a great place to be a little kid if you love your country. And a lot of the things that I still believe to this day, I know were installed in that time before we moved to Atlanta when I was 8 years old. But the bottom line was that morning or that afternoon, that experience and trying to, as a little child, contemplate the loss of who at the time was the ultimate rock star. We had just come through the Cuban Missile Crisis and all those different things. And Kennedy was surging toward a second term, and to have, you know, what was such a youthful, vibrant, just rock star president cut down at 46 years old. I mean, it was a traumatic experience. And again, they've killed the president is something I'll never, ever forget.
That is an amazing story. And again, that's one of those, where were you when it happened? That is one of those ground-shaking tectonic plate kind of events, and certainly the way it happened certainly brought a lot of that to the forefront. So that's a great start, and we're not trying to be, you know, I just lost a very dear friend of mine last week at the age of 82. She had just celebrated 51 years of sobriety, and so this is another reason why I kind of wanted to get into this. But I always want to celebrate life, no matter what time.
Yes.
Of their life they die. We're going to celebrate their life because we know they're going into greener pastures. 1990, June, we had started Classic Rock 99.5 in Birmingham on December 25th, 1988. So we're about a year and a half old. And I don't know if you remember when we came on the air, there hadn't been a Classic Rock station in Birmingham in about 6 or 7 years. There was just a waning, people just were dying for Classic Rock. We could have played anything we wanted to and people were going to love it. And so we came on and we just shot to the top. We were the number one Classic Rock station in the country. We had 20 shares. I mean, it was crazy. And so we were on stage every Classic Rock show that came. There were no Classic Rock shows in this town for 6 or 7 years until we came on the air because they needed someone to promote these shows. So there was a show out at Oak Mountain Amphitheater in June of 1990. It was Joe Cocker opening up for Stevie Ray Vaughan.
And, oh, wow.
And I got the opportunity. I was the stage guy, man. And if there was a Classic Rock show in town, I was the guy that was going to bring them on stage. And so I got a chance to meet Joe. And yes, Joe always looks like he just got out of a washing machine. And he looked like that night. He had the wife beater shirt on. He had the hairy chest, the whole nine yards. So I brought him on stage. And then Steve Ray Vaughan, I knew who Steve Ray Vaughan was. The only song I knew from him was Pride and Joy. And I hate to even admit that. I hadn't listened to any of his music, but he was on a scooter behind the stage, and I was trying to track him down. At that point in time, I always had CDs in my hand because I wanted to get autographs. And I walked up to him, and he rolled up to me, and I said, would you mind signing this? And he has the most beautiful autograph of anyone I've ever seen, period.
How about that?
People I haven't met, and I still have it. It's hanging on my wall. It's starting to fade a little bit, but it is absolutely beautiful. And he was on the scooter, and I asked him, I said, why are you on this scooter? And he said, well, I roll up to people, and he was super nice. He goes, I roll up to people, and if they start getting on my nerves a little bit, I just roll away. I don't have to walk away. He goes, I don't have to walk away and look rude. I just roll away like I accidentally hit the gas, and off I go. And so he's just rolling around. He was drinking a Coca-Cola and whatever. A guy who obviously, and it's well documented, had major issues with alcohol and drugs his entire life. And in 1986, he got sober after years of abuse. And wouldn't you know it, right after that, he is headlining Madison Square Garden for three consecutive nights. He played the Beale Street Music Festival. He was the headliner there in 1989. And then it was just an unbelievable meteoric rise for him, and it all kind of coincided with him getting sober. But 3 months after that show that I brought him on stage at Oak Mountain Amphitheater, he died in a helicopter crash from pilot error. And I'll just never forget it, because our radio station, excuse me, our radio station didn't play any Steve Ray Vaughan, didn't play any at all. And then when he passed away, we played like 7 or 8 of his songs. And I'm like, you know, why do we have to wait for this guy to die for us to start playing all of his music? Because his music is unbelievable. It's unmistakable if you listen to his chords and the way he plays guitar. And he was one of the most beloved blues artists of our time. And he passed away, on this date. And it was just, it was unfortunate. He passed away on August 27, 1990. And it just still affects me. And I keep thinking to myself, a guy who picked up the guitar at the ripe old age of 7 and just was unbelievable. And the fact that I got a chance to meet him and bring him on stage, it really affected me. And it was crazy. So there's my first one. What's your second?
Well, it's funny that, because this is along similar lines, and this is a person that I had made reference to in an earlier Need to Know episode that I did here on Tony Curry Radio. But the singer, songwriter, activist, Harry Chapin was such a big part of my life growing up, because we kind of discovered Harry, who was not commercially ultra successful, but was one of the most popular live acts, because this guy, Tony, was the Energizer Bunny on steroids. I mean, this guy played almost 5 or 6 out of 7 days every week. And by the end of his career and his untimely demise, Harry Chapin was playing more than half of his shows as benefits. He was involved in so many causes, so many humanitarian situations. And the show on Need to Know that I did about Harry was how the perception, when you hear political discourse these days and the quote progressive or woke or whatever you want to call it, leftist perspectives, people refer to them as liberals. And I was doing a show that day talking about how the definition of a liberal has become really kind of unfortunately altered, because Harry Chapin was the classic example of a great liberal. And I thought it would be interesting if people were starting to kind of tag me as being way on the other side, too conservative or whatever, that one of my greatest heroes was considered the ultimate liberal of his time, because the true sense of that word is somebody who wants to do for others and make people's lives better. And that is the purest form of what a liberal is. And Harry Chapin was just unbelievable. His music, he was underappreciated as an artist. He was a fabulous singer-songwriter. There are so many Harry Chapin songs. If you just listen to the lyrics, I mean, they resonate completely to this day. And Harry was going, as I mentioned, 1,000 miles a minute every day, like he knew that he had time that he had to maximize. Haunting lyrics in one of his latest songs called There Only Was One Choice. He talks about his possible demise and how thankful he is every morning to wake up. So it's almost like one of those eerie things where he just knew he didn't have very much time. Insiders on Capitol Hill, he came and just knocked on doors of congressmen and even basically bullied President Jimmy Carter at the time into creating a foundation that he was on the actual board, not an elected official, but Harry Chapin was on the Presidential World Hunger Council because that was his biggest issue. He could not understand, as I don't now. I still see commercials about talking about how many Americans are starving, and how many children won't have any lunch during the entire summer because school's closed. That's unacceptable, Tony. Hunger should not be a problem. That was what Harry was really fighting against. But his schedule had become so frenzied. He was always jumping on a plane and flying somewhere to do a benefit or go support a cause. And in 1981, on the Long Island Expressway, he either had some kind of seizure or passed out, maybe just fell asleep at the wheel. But all of a sudden, his car veered into like five lanes of traffic over and was slammed by a big rig truck. And Harry was killed on the spot at the age of 38 years old, really at the height of his effectiveness and his popularity as an artist. And I told the story, and I'll wrap this up, but I had just begun being the track announcer, the voice of Southland Greyhound Racing in Memphis, which was the largest, most successful greyhound track in the world. And at 21 years old, I was the man on the mic and did some radio programming. I bolted from interning in Atlanta, had the opportunity to get that job. My dad was associated with a lot of the executives there. We had this weird guy who was named Binocular Bill, who was a huge player, big gambler on the races, and so big they gave him this little, not really an office. It was kind of like in the boiler room or something on the steps on the way up to the judges' stand where my announcer's booth was. I'd never spoken to the guy, never had any kind of exchange at all. We passed on the steps a few times. I was walking up the steps that day in July, 1981, and he was coming down. And right when we kind of reached the point where we intersected, he looked up at me and said, "Harry Chapin died in an accident today." And I was just astounded by that news, because this was a guy, literally, Tony, that we, my friends and I, saw in concert. We went wherever he was playing probably 40 times in about a 12-year period. We saw Harry Chapin performances everywhere throughout the Southeast. But to have the news delivered from a guy that I had no relationship with, had never had a conversation with, that's still one of the most eerie, inexplicable things that's ever happened to me. Binocular Bob is the one who told me about Harry's demise.
That is unbelievable. A guy who sold 16 million records. And I remember two things about Harry. First of all, you talk about that car crash in 1981. I believe he was driving a Volkswagen Rabbit. I'll never
forget. Yes, that's right.
I was thinking, and people are like, why the hell is Harry Chapin driving a Volkswagen Rabbit? I'm like, that is so Harry. That was the perfect car for, he was driving a Volkswagen Rabbit. And the other thing is while Cats in the Cradle is obviously one of the most incredible songs, you still hear I cannot turn it off. It's like watching Forrest Gump. Every time I hear it, I go, I've heard it.
Yeah.
I can't turn it off. But we used to play Taxi, and he could not write a song without telling a miraculous story. His lyrics, you can make an argument that his lyrics were probably the most influential of any artist on the face of the earth. I mean, I would put that out there. If you really listen to his lyrics, every single song he had just had told a wonderful story. And
Tony, are you aware that on his last album, he recorded a song called Sequel, where he goes back 20 years later and goes and sees Sue, who he picked up in the taxi? Wow. If you haven't heard it, I know you've got all music at your fingertips. Go listen to Sequel, because it is absolutely brilliant.
I love that. I'll do that. When I got out of the jocks thing on sports radio, I had a headhunter who is just a good friend of mine. His name's David Brody. And he reached out to me, said, "Man, I'll help you out any single way you can." And he flew me to Charlotte. I went to Dallas. I went to Atlanta, worked at the game, and just trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. And he gave me a list of phone numbers. And he said, "I got some phone numbers here and I'll share them with you." He goes, "Don't give them out to anyone else, but if it helps you get along somewhere, I'll be more than happy to share them with you." I said, "Sure."
Awesome.
And there were the phone numbers of Jim Harbaugh. There was a Kirby Smart. He had Nick Saban's cell phone number. And he had all these individuals. So I sent a text message out to every one of them and just said, "Hey, this is Tony Curry. I've been doing sports radio for 20 years. If there's anything I can do for you, or if I can," and I was trying to figure out whether I wanted to do podcasts or start my own radio station. I wasn't sure what, and we were doing the Curry and Clapo thing. There was only one that returned my text, and he did almost immediately. As a matter of fact, I got a text back from this coach while I was still texting other coaches and it was Mike Leach.
Yeah.
And Mike didn't know me from Adam's house cat. Mike was out at Washington State, out in Pullman, Washington. And I just thought, wow, this guy has no clue who I am. I just kind of told him that I was doing sports radio. I had never interviewed the guy. And I reached out to him, and he picked up the phone, and we started talking. And so I was doing this Curry and Klepo thing, and I was on a couple of terrestrial radio stations. And I said, would you want to come on weekly? And this was like sometime in June or July. And he said, well, yeah. And he goes, what are we going to talk about? And Mike obviously was an incredibly colorful individual. And I said, man, I said, I'd rather have you during the off season than during the on season. You know, we could talk about X's and O's all day long. You know, why did you not have such a great, you know, third down conversion rate or whatever? Because the guy was just so colorful. And that's where most of his great little snippets that people just went viral with were about eating duck sandwiches or his swords or piracy or whatever he got into. And so he obviously had moved on. And then, of course, he's the coach at Mississippi State. And obviously, that's right in our backyard in SEC land. And I was doing a show on the Jay Barker radio network, and I was trying to get him to come join us. And obviously now that he's, you know, in the SEC, he really was interested in talking with me because he could make an imprint recruiting wise in SEC country, certainly with Tuscaloosa 45 minutes down the road. So he came on and he said, well, listen, he goes, I can't come on live with you, but I will record something with you this afternoon. So I called Jay and said, listen, I'm going to record something with Mike Leach and we can play it on your show tomorrow when I come in. It was on a Thursday. And he said, that'd be fine. So Mike comes on, and he has got this hell of a cough. I mean, he is just hacking up during the entire interview, so much so that I kind of started laughing because it was unbelievable. He couldn't answer a question without just absolutely just coughing, and he'd have to pull the phone down and pull it back up. And he's like, I'm sorry. And I said, no, it's no problem. I can clean this up. And I thought, you know what? This is Mike Leach at his best. You know, he didn't care. He was doing me a favor, and I said, no, it's fine. We'll just keep it in there. And I said, are you okay? And he said, I think I've got pneumonia. And he started laughing a little bit. He goes, you know, I'm around all these college kids. There's no telling what kind of disease I have. And we started laughing about it. 6 days later, he dies. And I don't know if there was any direct correlation to that particular cough he had or pneumonia. I know they talked about having a heart attack. And I just couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it because, I had him on, one of our shows, whether it was terrestrial, whether it was podcast, whether it was Curry and Klepo, whether I was just doing something, I had him on every single week for 3 years. And I really got to know the guy, so much so that at one point we were doing a show on a Saturday night and I called him and we were doing a show from 7 to 10 PM Central Time. And I called him around 9:30 and he answered the phone and he sounded kind of out of breath. I said, hey coach, what's going on? He's like, what's going on? What can I do for you, Tony? I said, nothing, man. We're just checking in with you. See if you can give us a few minutes on the air here. And he goes, well, it's halftime. So I got a few minutes. And I said, halftime of what? He goes, we're playing Colorado tonight. And I said, oh, and I didn't even realize. And he picked up his phone during the halftime of the Washington State Colorado game. And he goes, I can give you 5 minutes. I said, no, I don't want to be. He goes, no. He goes, I get 5 minutes. He goes, halftime's 20 minutes. I get 5 minutes. He goes, I've already talked to the team. They're already out of the locker room. Let's go. And he spoke with us for 5 minutes. And I could not believe this guy picked up his phone during the halftime of a Washington State Colorado game. He was just a sweetheart of a guy. He was a great guy. And I did a Facebook Live afterwards and I cried. I mean, I cried. I just, not so much because I knew the man, but because he was so sly and beautiful with his time. And he was the only guy that returned my phone call. And I thought, man, I wonder how many other people he affected that way. And so that was another guy that really affected me as far as in a celebrity or infamous death. So there you have
such it. An unusual guy, Tony, because he was interested in everything and had an opinion on everything.
He was a voracious reader, reader, loved to read.
I know you're familiar with this, but I love the aspect of his time at Washington State where they thought, you know, somebody was wise enough to say, this guy is so interesting. And I forgot exactly what the course was, but it was something about warfare strategy as it applies to football or something along those lines, because he was such an expert on everything that ever happened. And they, you know, they thought, well, we'll just let him teach a class in that, you know, in the summer quarter or semester or whatever it was. And you know, it that might be something that students would want to take as an elective. It wasn't a credit. 50,000 students signed up to be in that class, which was just ridiculous. And of course, they only could take, 100 or whatever. But that says it all about what a just an infectious personality Mike Leach has. And I remember just being stunned the night that happened as well, because this guy was so colorful and such a different kind of animal. And, all that last season, as you mentioned, Terry and I talked about it a bunch on our football show, how he was constantly struggling with respiration and the cough in all of his press conferences. He just seemed like he was really battling something. So it wasn't, I guess, stunning when it happened, but it was totally just heartbreaking, because this was one of the real eclectic, interesting, great guys we've ever dealt with.
He was 61 years of age, and when that Auburn job opened up, everyone thought maybe he was going to be taking that job, and they thought, would this be a good fit down there? And obviously he's like, no, I'm happy here at Mississippi State. And I think he would have probably stayed there for the rest of his life, but he was a great guy, and he was a character for sure. Who's your third person?
Well, I'm going to kind of combine my third and fourth, because they happened almost consecutively.
Okay.
In a corridor in 1977, right out of high school, I had been whisked away. My dad had been transferred from Atlanta to Memphis. My folks had divorced about 5 years earlier. And this is in the early 70s when that really didn't happen very often. So that was kind of a big thing that I was trying to deal with and come to grips with, but had really become estranged from my dad because I, left under circumstances that were basically very narcissistic and hooked up with somebody much younger. And, kind of the classic story that's cliche now, but back in that era, just wasn't as prevalent. But my dad reached out to me and asked me about my college plans late in my senior year at high school, and really made a big sales pitch for me to come to Memphis and go to Memphis State and live with him, because he was going to get a big break, of course, financially. And the incentive for me was, if I came to Memphis State, he would buy me a car. And that was a deal. That was a deal clencher.
That's a good one.
Of course, the sad part of that story, Tony, is I didn't get a Firebird or a Camaro. My dad was the regional manager for Johnson Wax, and I got a big green station wagon that had been a salesman's car to carry. So that was my first car. So that part of the deal, but I didn't care. I had wheels. I was 17 years old at the time. Once again, I was ahead of the curve in terms of my where I should not have been in college at 17, but I was. But anyway, going to Memphis that first year, 76 and into 77, really became immersed in that culture. And because of the racetrack, there was a lot of guys that hung out there that sat in this kind of private room where my dad sat and my future father-in-law. I met my wife and the mother of my children through that experience. But a lot of these guys were members of the, quote, Memphis Mafia. And they were guys that were Elvis's, kind of crew, the guys he hung out with, the guys that went on the road and set up his shows, all the guys that, he had been friends with for a long time. You'd mentioned Jerry Lee Lewis a few weeks ago on our program. And a lot of those guys were in that group. So kind of immersed in that society and just routinely riding up and down the road over in that part of town, you would go by Graceland, and Elvis actually lived there.
Yeah. I mean,
Elvis was still performing, had gotten kind of rotund and unhealthy looking, but he was still, but by the image makers, he was still, heavily involved in karate and working out, and he was obsessed with law enforcement like a lot of people. He would ride along with the sheriffs, and so he still was kind of putting out that macho image. So I'd gone home for the summer that year and was preparing to go back to Memphis State for the fall semester when the word came down on August 16th of 1977, after being around all of that, Elvis's death was absolutely stunning. Yeah. Nobody saw that coming. Nobody expected it. I just remember the impact of saying, gosh, I felt like I knew the guy. I mean, I never actually had a personal encounter, but he was just such an enormous part of that city that I had just lived for a year that, you know, it really shook me a week before I was going to return to a completely different Memphis now. And, you know, the rest of that story was I did finish my second year at Memphis and then had a chance to go to work and I never returned. But the impact of that day was just stunning because I remember just being just totally in shock because Elvis was in his 40s. I mean, you know, you just didn't see that coming. And I think when you have the demise of somebody so epically famous and such an institution, and it's really under surprising circumstances, and this wasn't something you could really kind of come to grips with. We all know the story now of the massive drug addictions and all of the different issues and his family having such a terrible history of heart dysfunction. But at that day, it was stunning. Right after that, and I'll tie this with my other one. Right after that, it seems like, and I don't know exactly what the time frame is. It could have been just before, but right in that same corridor of time in that summer, I had gone reluctantly because I really wasn't into what you would call Southern rock. But my friend Joe convinced me to go to a show at the Alexander Memorial Coliseum in downtown Atlanta to see Lynyrd Skynyrd. Oh. And Tony, what a revelation. That show was the highest energy, most enthusiastic crowd I've ever seen. You know, that was really the facility. It surprised me to this day. I don't know why they played there instead of the Omni, which was the, you know, the Flames and the Hawks home and a lot more seating. But the fact that seated only about 12,000, and they were really rolling at the time. So this was probably July or August of that year as well. And I just was obsessed with Lynyrd Skynyrd after that. Loved every one of the songs, got into the albums, was listening to it night and day. And then on October 20th, that same year, 1977, just 2 months after Elvis, they got on a transport plane in Greenville, South Carolina, and flying on the way to Baton Rouge for a concert the next night with the whole band and backup singers and crew. That plane went down because the pilots had misjudged on the fuel and they were out of gas. About a half an hour short of their destination, they tried to make to another airport that was down in that part of Mississippi, realized they weren't going to make it, tried to land in a vacant field, and tragically went down hard enough where 5 people on that plane, including Ronnie Van Zant, the singer and founder, and many other, Steve Gaines and his sister Cassie, who was terrified to fly, was already in the equipment truck that was bringing all of their sound and all their amps and everything else to Baton Rouge. He was going to ride with those guys in the truck, and Ronnie Van Zant convinced her to get on that plane, and that was her demise. She was one of the 5 people killed. To have those things happen back to back was just devastating, and I to this day am haunted by those memories and just still voraciously read every detail I can get, because that was just 2 completely stunning things that happened within the space of about 2 months.
So those are 2 huge ones, and I certainly could make an argument that they affected me as well. But great stories, fantastic stories, Kip. I was going to go, and I'll do my third and fourth one on top of each other as well. I was going to go with Eddie Van Halen just because it's been so recent. Yes. Died 3 years ago this October, and a lot of people don't realize, but Eddie Van Halen was born in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. You want to win a drink somewhere? Ask somebody where Eddie Van Halen was born. He was actually born in Amsterdam, started playing the guitar when he came to America at the age of 7 years of age, and obviously in Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But I wanted to pick a different one, and this was one of those deaths where it really didn't affect me when it happened, but it affected me about 13 years later. And that would be John Lennon. John Lennon, of course, shot outside of his New York Manhattan apartment back in 1980. And strange enough, by a fan who loved the Beatles and loved John Lennon. And to this day, we'll say the only reason he shot John Lennon was to become famous. And yes. And he was, and actually had an album in his hand that was autographed by John Lennon when he actually shot him in cold blood in 1980. So fast forward 13 years later, and I was 14 when John Lennon passed away. I was into radio already, and I realized that it was just it was almost too big for me to consume that one of the Beatles died that way and died, period. So 1993, I'm at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I used to do something every year on February 14th. We used to marry a couple. They have a studio up on the fourth floor. It's a five-story pyramid-looking thing. And you were mentioning Elvis. One of the years I was up there, they had all Elvis memorabilia. It's on loan. And they had the TV that he shot with a gun, and they had the toilet that he was sitting on when he actually died. And it was unbelievable to see that. If you never gotten a chance to go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, even if you don't like music, you need to go. You could spend 3 or 4 days in the place and not see the same thing twice. But I get up in the studio, and right outside the studio to the left-hand side, there was a white bed. And it was a king-size bed, and it was all white. And the bed part was actually made out of two church pews. The front, of course, and you could see the pockets in the side, and then there were pockets on the inside of the headboard, and they were two church pews. And the entire bed was white. The screws were white. The sheets were white. The bedboards, everything was white. And then next to that bed was a table, a white table with a white phone. And there was a little sign next to it, and it said, to celebrate John Lennon's, and they had the shirt that he was wearing when he was shot. They had the glasses that he was wearing when he was shot. They had all this stuff that you could see at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But this little sign said, once a week, this phone will ring. Please pick it up. It'll be Yoko. You can talk to Yoko. And I was like,
oh my goodness.
Well, you know, I'm a blessed man. And everyone's like, you know, how do these things happen to you? Why are you always in these situations? I walk out of the studio and that phone rings. And I got so nervous. First of all, I didn't know if I'd be able to understand Yoko. But I got so nervous and I picked up the phone, and sure enough, it was Yoko Ono. And I was like, man, if there was a way, and I think I even said, hey, can you wait a second so I can run in the studio and try to record this? And she's like, I only have a few minutes. And I said, okay. And I spoke with Yoko Ono, and I didn't even know what to ask her. I just told her, I said, I really appreciate the fact that she loaned all of this memorabilia to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame so that true Beatles and John Lennon fans could actually see all these things. And they had John Lennon report cards from his third and fourth grade. I mean, it was unbelievable. So that was probably one that really affected me, but it did 13 years after his death. Finally, and then we'll wrap this up. And I was trying to figure out who my fourth is going to be, and I'm going to make it a group of people. I love radio, and I know you love radio too. And I love everything about it. And something, whenever I get interested in something, I love to learn the history of it. And I know you're a history buff too. So when I got into radio, you know, we had to take meter readings every hour. You had to have a license. You had to take a test in order to get a radio license. Now anyone could be on the radio. And I was into Marconi, and I was into Rudolf Hertz, and I was into Tesla. I was into all the guys that really were the frontiers or the trailblazers for this industry that I call my career. And I would like to recognize all the radio personalities that we've lost. I think of Doug Layton, who I did so many radio shows for and was such just a joy to work with. I think about Andy Spinozzi, a guy that I've always dreamt of doing a morning show with, and I never got a chance to do it. He had a heart attack, and then he was back, and then he had another heart attack, and it took his life. I think about Lee Davis. I don't know if you remember him. I think about Ben Cook, who was probably the biggest baseball fan I've ever met.
Oh, Ben,
the guy I love.
Absolutely.
The guy was the only guy. He would show up at Barons games with his scorebook. He would actually score the game as the game went on. He loved baseball. Ed Willoughby. I think about Ed Willoughby. I think about Robbie Rags. I think about all the guys that did radio that just, you know, some lost their lives way too early. Some probably pushed it a little too hard. Some obviously lived illustrious lives and lived it out in radio land. But I think about all those former radio people that I got a chance to work with, and I had just a wonderful conversation with a young lady named Sherry Thomas, who's been around radio probably about as long as I have been. And we were just talking about all the radio. Lee Davis was one of these guys that he was quirky. He was strange. If you're in radio, you're a little off. I always say that everyone in the radio industry has got autism. We're on the autism spectrum at some point. There's something wrong with us. And that's why we love doing radio, because we don't make a lot of money doing it. We do it for the love of, we don't do it for the fame, but we enjoy it and we're good at it. And so I think about all those people that we've lost in radio land when it comes to people that really affected my life.
Yeah, quick thoughts. I know we were running long.
No, but, go ahead.
On John Lennon, Mark David Chapman. Remember his motivation? Yes, to be famous, but to impress Jodie Foster. He was absolutely obsessed with her. And the other thing about the Lennon death was, it's shocking how America learned that happened. It was right in the middle of a Monday night football game.
Was. Yes.
Howard Cosell, of all people, is the person who broke the story nationally when it was confirmed that John Lennon had been shot. And I'll never forget that moment.
And he was friends with John. He had John actually in the studio with him, right?
Yeah.
John Lennon was in the studio for Monday Night Football. Can you imagine?
John Lennon had stopped by the booth on an earlier game that year and was talking about, you know, this makes our shows look like a tea party. it was his quote. But I'll never forget Howard Cosell. It's now confirmed John Lennon dead at whatever 40, whatever year old he was. But to hear from Howard Cosell was amazing. And great tribute to so many fantastic names. I had the chance to work with Lee Davis, who, like you said, was a really unique guy. Ben Cook shared my love of baseball. Ben would talk baseball with you for hours. Ben was the first guy to ever take me over to Rickwood Field for a ceremony we had going on that day with Jocks, because he was the original partner of the one and only Herb Winches, of course.
The franchise,
on Sports Talk 690. And that show, Tony, I know you're aware of this because you were across the hall at the time making history with 99.5 with the rock station. But Herb and Ben's show was really one of the pioneering shows of all sports radio. It was unheard of at the time when that idea was kicked off by Dick Broadcasting here. Herb and Ben were the original show on Sports Talk 690. And as a young broadcaster, being able to fill in when one of them was out was one of the great experiences and really one of the great memories of my life. Because Ben, what a terrific guy. We went to Rickwood Field and they were letting us actually throw to a catcher off the mound. And I was still kind of a young guy and was a pretty good baseball player. I was bringing it. Ben was impressed. He goes, "Man, you can really bring it up there." And I told somebody this story just the other day. Ben being such a baseball aficionado, that was one of the best compliments I ever had. But I also did a Saturday morning show that followed Doug and John Ed Willoughby, who were on from 6 to 10. And it was the most hilarious show of all time because they had no content. It was just a running infomercial from deals. They both had
it was. Sentence. It was 2 hours of all commercials. They would mention one sentence. Hey, did you see that game last Monday night? Well, if you did, you were probably watching it at LaVoy's. And I'm like, what in the world? It was exactly. One long. It was awesome.
So-and-so dry cleaners. They had deals with everybody in town.
That is hilarious. That was so good. I miss those guys. And you talk about Herb Winches. He used to call himself the franchise. That's a man I went to four different Olympics with. I mean, I betted with that guy in Barcelona when he got shingles in Barcelona. I betted with him when we went to Albertville, France. I betted with him when we had literally betted with him in Atlanta. But a great guy and doing
and Lily and Norway, right?
And Lillehammer, yeah, Lillehammer, Norway, and of course Ben's gone, but Herb continues to live on. Now he's got his restaurant up at Lay Lake, and he's got his little houses, and he's doing really, really well. And he looks good too, by the way. And
he really does. Herb's still going strong.
Hit him straight. So, hello again, everybody. Yeah, he was the franchise.
That's it.
He was the franchise for sure. Hey, great show, Kip. And by the way, you bring this up, and maybe this could be a show that we could get into a little bit later on in Kiefer and Curry, but. I can't believe Major League Baseball is going to be playing the Field of Dreams game at Rickwood Field. How cool is that coming up next year?
Is that awesome or what?
I was just telling my son a week before they announced that about Rickwood Field, and I told him what part of town it was in. He's like, really? And I was like, son, it's the oldest ballpark in the United States of America. And I said, that thing has been on its last leg for so many years. And I said, even the Barons, I don't think are doing any games out anymore, but they will pick it back up next year. But I said, you know, when you walk through that ballpark, you feel the history. I mean, it's like, I've never walked through the White House, and I can just imagine knowing that Abe Lincoln and all these presidents have walked through the hallways. But when you're, it's almost like going to the Mount of Olives. I mean, it's like, I don't even know how to describe it. And I looked in every nook and cranny of that stadium. I spent 6 hours just trying to find a piece of history. I wanted to I wanted to find a baseball card or writing or something that was sketched on a wall or something. And the fact that Willie Mays, of course, at the age of 92, is going to be recognized with that game, I think is going to be, and it's super stinking hot. It is small, but man, you don't even think they're going to be wearing the wool jerseys and stuff. And it's just going to be super cool to see that happening. So we could certainly talk about that. That's going to be awesome.
Yeah. I'm glad the whole country is going to get a glance at that, because a lot of folks aren't familiar with its history. My son actually played some tournament games there. And so it's a big thrill for him to see that announcement. I walked around the whole stadium like you. I went up in the press box. There are tons of framed photos, signed photos of some of the most astounding stars that ever played the game that played at Rickwood Field.
Yep.
Guys like Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson, even Reggie Jackson, you think of more of a modern day guy.
Ty Cobb.
The Barons played there. That was their home park for right up until the time when they moved downtown. So great stuff.
All right, man. We'll do it again next week. For Kiefer and Curry, make sure you check out and get the TKR app. You can hear this show at least 5 days a week. And, of course, wherever you get your podcasts, we're available on every major indice out there. Tony Curry Radio. Just pull up Kiefer and Curry, and you can listen to our shows. It says Kiefer and Curry with a big old microphone. We'll get after it right here. Until next week, we thank you for listening.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.